management was the evil force that somehow ruined the companies and things like that, and I hope that's not the case.
Well,
but
I was an early programmer, actually.
So you've done both sides of the fence.
I really do appreciate that. I mean, those guys are, you know, they do the game.
But it just strikes me that there's always that tension there between management, and when I saw that you are listed as officially the management views, I thought, good, we finally get a spokesman from the suits on the other side. This is Mr. Stephen Wyatt. He's been with Atari and Activision during their heyday, and I'm just going to shut up and let him take it away and tell you what it was like to be involved with those companies at that time.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's on. Okay. So one of the things that I find most interesting is really more the questions, you know, that the audience has about things that went on that time. Sometimes, if I stop and think about it, I start to feel a little old because, you know, having been around, actually been a programmer before there actually were cartridge games out. But some of the stuff that I've done from doing Fortran 4 programming and things with numbers from before the cartridge game industry, and then from Atari, and then in Activision, being with Activision from the days when they were less than a year old, and they went from $5 million to $65 million in 1 year, and from being at one building at Scott Boulevard to adding a manufacturing facility in Milpitas, and then going to Activision Twin Towers in Mountain View, to going to Telesis and being the director of operations at Telesis and seeing how we could actually use the existing Wong family in Hong Kong to make our video games and market those. Watching the video game industry while I was at Telesis go from $29.99 games, you know, down to $4.10, you know, in wholesale. Seeing programmers, independent programmers, that a couple of years before would be able to bring in a game and try to sell it for $250,000, and then, you know, a few years later see programmers try to get $25,000 for a game. And then going from there to a company called Inventory Transfer Systems, which was the first, in my mind, actual electronic distribution of software, where the concept was to have any of the games that were licensed come out on any cartridge media, where you could walk into a kiosk in a department store. And there actually was one place where their kiosks came out, and that was in Great Britain, in the Menzies department stores, and they used them there to download software on a cassette tape for the Commodore 64, but it never got going in this country. So actually, I'd like to just entertain any questions that the audience might have about any of those things or any of those companies. And if not, I'll just go on. No, huh?
Not yet.
Well. Sure. An amazing thing, in 1981, in the fall of 1981, I went over to Atari and was going to work for the quality manager, actually the director of quality over there for all of Atari. And within 1 week's time, I was whisked away by Activision and got a better offer from Activision. And I was with Activision until in 1982, Activision had a family vacation, where, as I was telling Mark a little while ago, they actually decided they were going to take everybody to Hawaii. And they gave out this great little promo bag. It was a green shoulder bag that had the Activision color logo on it. And it was a little after that that Telesis had taken me away. And at Telesis, as the director of operations, they had gone to the first CES show and with two games, one which I thought was just crazy. It was so silly. It was Coconuts. That was their first game, which, you know, you see this guy walk back and forth. And also with Fast Food. And that was a lot more fun. I liked that game. So I spent a good part of the next year, probably up to 2 months at a time, going over to the Far East and making sure that they were setting up, and there was tooling that was being made in this country, and also using the ROM manufacturers from this country and sending the items over to Hong Kong. So my timeline with that was into 82, and then into 83 with the as they wound the company down and actually made money selling product cheap at distress prices. At the same time, a couple of guys from Texas came to me, and they were contracted with some people inside Atari to do Atari Soft. And we did a number of Atari Soft titles, both Commodore 64 and VIC 20, and we did some disc products too. I remember we did an IBM and an Apple disc product, IBM Pac-Man and Apple II Defender. That bridged into, I think it was the late 1983 to early 1984, but if anybody can correct me on that, that would be fine. Because at the same time, I had this Chicago syndicate come, and they were the ones that bankrolled inventory transfer systems that was going to come out with this great electronic distribution system. And that went all through 84, right up until the end of 84. And was actually sold to British Telecom in early 1985.
And from Activision, obviously, you know, a trendsetter in business, amazing games, Telesis, which is not exactly a company known for its great games. Why?
Well, you know, I you know, that's a good point. I mean, what was just amazing for me at the time with Activision was they were starting to come out with such great graphics. I mean, you know, you would look at an Atari box, you would look at what Atari wanted to put out, and then Activision would just come out with these fabulous graphics, and it was extremely exciting. You know, I think that Activision did a lot to get the video game industry, you know, in terms of acceptance, you know, of a product that on the screen it looked really, really good. I'm sure any of you probably in your life have had a situation where somebody comes to you and says, you know, do you want to run the whole show on something? And, you know, at that point in time, it was like, wow, you know, that sounded really exciting. Sounded really exciting to, you know, like work with the programmers and work, you know, directly with, you know, the head of marketing and the head of sales. And the guy in sales and the guy in marketing had been with Columbia House Record Club, you know, and they certainly knew how to sell records, they knew how to sell tapes, they thought they could sell cartridges. And the thing in the back of my mind that was always bugging me was I had seen, you know, years earlier, things like radar detectors and CB radios, you know, that had these great, you know, run-ups in sales and then just absolutely crashed. And it seemed to me like, you know, something like that could happen in the video game industry. And so I thought, well, you know, it probably would be a good time to get as high as I could in management because, you know, that would give me, in Silicon Valley, that would give me the chance to, you know, propel my career further than that. So that's really why. But the other thing, too, that was really exciting in the video game industry was, you know, being able to, instead of just having a job in a cubicle somewhere, it was really being able to get out and being able to, you know, like work with different programmers or work with different marketing companies. And so that was pretty exciting. You know, it was exciting to really just be around a lot of people there that were really making it happen. And, you know, anybody that was around Atari in the beginning, you know, seeing Atari go from, you know, one building to multiple buildings and being able to be around Nolan Bushnell and you know, just, you know, all these people that were like gods in the industry, it was just a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun even, you know, being with from the Activision programmers to being with all these independent programmers that were coming into Telesis all the time with games.
Questions? Right there.
Well, yeah, not really from Atari. I got to tell you, you know, like one of the things that you know, there are stories about the first five programmers at Activision, you know, having come over from Atari, and Atari trying to sue to get them, having been at, I remember the first Consumer Electronics Show that we came to in Las Vegas. Activision was going to put on a big splash. We did a parade in town, you know, from, I can't even remember where it was. It was a really chilly morning. There was frost on the ground. We were all freezing, you know, and we were dressed in these Activision, you know, promo things. And just, you know, the programmers were not going to parade. They just decided, you know, no, they were too good for it. They were not going to parade. It was too cold. You were going to get them a car or a limo or something to ride in. And you know, Jim Levy, the head of Activision at the time, you know, had this real, you know, little mutiny on his hands going on behind there. And it was the same thing. You know, that's really where I saw more of that mutinous kind of activity going on, which was, you know, really at Activision. Not, you know, to say anything bad about any individual either. It was really amusing to see this and to wonder, it's like, am I going to have a job tomorrow? Is this place going to, like, blow up in everybody's face? Because, you know, we were dependent on the programmers. You know, we were really dependent on them. And, you know, at any one particular time, I mean, when you talk about people creating job security, the way to create job security is be working on a lot of games, but don't finish any of them. you know, so that they need you right up until the last minute. So, I mean, that's really my recollection. My recollection was everybody really wondering about job security. And I would tell you, you know, like anybody that was a staff person or a consultant that came to Activision, and a lot of people that came in as consultants went off and started Imagic and, you know, started to work at some of these other companies. Any of them left because they were concerned about, you know, they saw some riff and immediately they thought, oh man, I'm going to be out of a job tomorrow. So, you know, they decided to leave.
Any questions? Okay.
So my question is about your job description at Activision, your project manager.
Now, actually, I got hired in by Alan Epstein, who is the vice president, as the quality manager. But there was no manufacturing manager at the time either, and we were using Selectron as a contract manufacturer. Selectron had been contract manufacturing for Atari, and they were also making these little dumb terminals for Falco data products, and they decided that they would use Selectron to do the contract manufacturing for Activision. The people that came in Activision were extremely quality conscious, and so there was this big disconnect between what they actually wanted and what they could possibly get from a contract manufacturer. And so we actually, myself and the people that I hired as supervisors under me, we wore a number of different hats. And we were constantly, that's where the stress came in, you know, really going from the meetings about what Activision really wanted and then having to translate that to a quality product. Also at the time that Activision was embroiled in a number of lawsuits that Atari was launching against them. Atari launched lawsuits against them for the two little pins that were in the cartridge that were supposed to lift the dust cover from the unit, saying that the type of pins we had, since we didn't have springs on them, you know, could damage the dust cover unit and effectively damage the connector. And you know, there were all of these little lawsuits going on in the background too. Activision came up with a piece of foam to put over the edge of the circuit board and the two little pins, you know, to emulate the dust cover that Atari had. Well, also foam, like they had, was highly static sensitive, I mean charge sensitive, and you know, this wasn't an area that we were thinking too much at the time. You know, we had ESD connectors on people putting chips in circuit boards and you know, soldering them, but you know, they'd slap this piece of foam on, and if somebody was rubbing it, you know, waiting for a cartridge to come down the line, they'd do that, it went. You know, the next station they had them plug into a 2600 to make sure that every game worked, and all of a sudden you came up with cartridges that, you know, like were just doing screwy things. So there was a number of disconnects there, and there was a number of, you know, really, you know, potential just nightmares in terms of you know, stress on the job and really translating the quality level that the people in management at Activision wanted to actually what came out in the box. And we felt, you know, that people deserved it, that the consumer deserved it. If they were paying $29 or $39 for a cartridge, they deserved a quality product.
So that was quality of manufactured goods, as opposed to say quality of software.
Yes. No, as a matter of fact, one of the things that Activision, during the time that Activision was did everything in-house, Activision had all of their promotional materials, all of the game instructions, all of the boxes, all of the labels and stickers, everything made in this country. As a matter of fact, we use the same vendors that Atari did. And because of that, that's another interesting story. The companies that printed the instruction sheets and the boxes and even the labels, Atari came to them and said, if you do business with any other game manufacturer, and so what they did was they actually created, I mean, you talk about with the Enron scale and everything, having companies in the Grand Cayman Islands. I mean, this was one of those situations where they had companies which were sheer shell companies, marketing companies, like on the other side, you know, in New York and in Connecticut and New Jersey, you know, simply for the fact of being able to take Activision's orders and have the stuff printed, you know, somewhere. And it was printed right next to the Atari boxes. It was printed right next to the Atari, instruction sheets. But Atari was not supposed to know that, you know, the same companies that were doing their work was doing. We had our plastic game cartridges injection molded right on the peninsula between San Francisco and San Jose by the same companies that were also doing it. Well, what they had to do was they couldn't injection mold our cartridges in the same facility that they did the Atari cartridges. So they had to find other injection molders, you know, in the area and subcontract those out. So now it's kind of like, you know, if you're if you've got you know a husband, a wife, a girlfriend, or a boyfriend, you know, you're married to one person, but you're supposed to go to another house to get your meals, you know, because the neighbors aren't supposed to know. Yeah, it's quite interesting.
Any other questions? I had a question about the kiosk idea. This still fascinates me. And I assume the reason that didn't come into effect is that the market crashed, and they, at least in this country, maybe they didn't see the games industry as being healthy at the time. But I'm just surprised that idea hasn't come up after that, considering that cartridge format continued for another decade or so, and even now with CDs, there must be some way of bypassing, you know, the retailer and doing it right, you know, copying disc to disc on the kiosk unit and having the consumer pay for it right from there.
You know, it's an interesting thing, because when we were negotiating with the various video game companies at Inventory Transfer Systems, where I was a vice president, and what they would talk about was shelf space. And what actually it was very important in the video game industry at that time was how much shelf space you could have at a retailer. And Atari would have tremendous amount of shelf space. And any of the other ones, whether it was Imagic or Activision or Coleco, you know, they had less shelf space. And it seemed like one of the conversations that would always come up, and we didn't really know how to handle it, because it was a surprise to us, was, you know, they wanted their box with their colors, and they wanted it on the shelf, and they wanted as much shelf space as possible. And so when you're going to these video game companies and you're saying, we'll actually download your product, we'll save you the money of actually having to manufacture this thing, because as we would all see, you know, when the video game industry crashed, lots of people had lots of inventory, you know, and they had lots of money there in that inventory. But what a number of the companies were worried about was all of a sudden the visual for their product would disappear. If their product wasn't sitting there on a shelf, people, you know, it was an impulse buy. People wouldn't see it. People might not buy it. And it was also a prestige issue. You know, they wanted their boxes on the shelf. And that was one of the objections that we couldn't overcome. You know, boxes and instruction manuals were relatively easy and fast to print and to actually have on the shelf. You know, one of the things that they were talking about in the previous session for the collectibles was, you know, you could have a shrink-wrapped box with a piece of blank media inside, but the value was, you know, in the perception that there was something inside. And, you know, when I heard that, I thought to myself, now that would have been a way to get around it, where you could have actually printed the instruction manuals, printed the boxes, had them on the shelf, but you actually didn't have to go through the, you know, making the media, whether it was a cartridge, whether it was a disc, whatever, you know, and actually you could have had those later. You know, you could have even mailed them to people, you know, if you wanted to do that. Because what they did was, they were going to hand out the media. You were going to have the media, the cartridge or the disc. You were going to be able to get it right then and there. And they were going to mail you the instruction booklet. Because we tried all types of little printers, dot matrix printers. You know, there really wasn't a use of lasers at that time, to try to print out an instruction manual right then and there to give it to them. And it just didn't have the look and the feel of something that was glossy and had colors to it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Any other questions from the audience?
So the question is, do I have an opinion about what happened to Atari? If you were able to see Atari at that time, they moved into a complex in North San Jose that was just this fabulous campus with five new buildings, and they had lots and lots of people there. They had an extremely expensive payroll. And I remember in the days of when they came out with the idea of Atari Soft, we would have to go over to Atari for the contracts. One of the things that we were really scared of was laying out the money to do the Atari Soft program and not getting repaid, because we had heard a lot of internal rumors at that time. As a matter of fact, a lot of people from Atari were leaving, and because they knew people inside the company, they were getting the contracts to do Atari Soft. And I remember going over there and just seeing people leaving in drones. I mean, they would go in and they would just, you know, they would lay off or fire an entire floor, you know, in a building. I'm sorry, not an entire floor, but an entire area of cubicles. And you would just see these people that were white-faced, you know, taking these little white banker's boxes, you know, cardboard boxes with their stuff and walking out. And so, you know, I think my opinion, number one, is that you know, Atari blindly thought that they were going to continuously be the leader in the industry, even though there were a lot of people giving them a lot of good comments about what they should be doing about their product. and they really weren't listening to them. And second of all, they had a huge payroll, and they were starting to run deficits like crazy. So, you know, having originally been a programmer and loving programming, you know, having been in all areas of management, and also having seen, you know, the demise of the video game industry while I was at Telesis, you know, even before I did the AtariSoft stuff, you know, I could just, the handwriting was on the wall. And for those of you that, you know, were interested in people like Jack Tramiel, who then, you know, had Commodore and went and did his leverage buyout of Atari, I mean, it was something where you could see, you know, it was going to be a house of cards, only because a person like Jack Tramiel wouldn't, you know, Jack Tramiel thought Jack Tramiel was God, and he wasn't going to listen to anybody. And so if you go into a particular business, or you go into a company that's just been suffering from something, and you get somebody else that's going to do a leverage buyout and thinks they know what to do and they're not going to listen to anybody anyway, you know, it's history's going to repeat itself. So, and that's just my opinion, for what it's worth.
After the game industry, where did you go to after Telesis, and did you stay involved in any form, or was you pretty much said that's enough?
Well, you know, it wasn't so much the game industry or not the game industry. As a matter of fact, in 1985, the computer industry with inventory transfer systems, its biggest problem was is in this kiosk that they were going to download. At the time, you had Z80 processors were powering rack-mounted computer systems, you know, really before the IBM PC still hadn't caught on really as a personal computer of the future. And people were using Motorola-based processor, you know, computer systems. Anyway, the computer industry also was taking a dive in 1985. But what was very interesting was is that I had been working with so many venture capitalists. Venture capitalists were putting the money into the video game industry, and there were other people coming to them with possibilities. Atala, which was a company that started doing the card scan for credit cards and for ATM cards that you would see even to this day sometimes on at the counter at the bank if you want to scan your card. Atala went to Jack Melchor, who was the M in Rome Corporation and was a very big venture capitalist, and he was going to fund Atala, and I had gotten such a good reputation for being able to bring a product from imagination through to conception, you know, for the people in the video game industry, that I actually got involved with. Got involved with being a resource for venture capitalists that wanted things done. So I actually had a group of about five people that were engineers and designers for hardware and for plastics and circuit boards and things like that, that we started doing a lot of contract work for companies that were being bankrolled by the same investors that had invested in the video game industry. So that's something that I did for about the next 5 years and did very well in and around the video game industry right in Silicon Valley.
Any other questions? Any more questions? Okay, then I'd like to thank you, Stephen, for
coming. Yeah, I thank you very much for being here, and thanks very much for your questions. And thank you very much for supporting the conference here. I think this is a great place, and, you know, we all enjoy it no matter, you know, what stage of gaming that we're in or what our interests in gaming are. So thanks very much.
I agree with you.